listening to Food Confidence, a podcast about approachable health and imperfect food, all for the sake of the next generation. I'm Jennifer Bravo.
And I'm Andrea Paul. We are two non-diet health professionals on a mission to empower parents and caregivers in raising food and body confident kids. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Food Confidence Podcast. Today we have a really great episode for you. Jen and I are here and we are going to be doing a Q&A. So if you follow us on our Instagram page, we put out a little call to action or call to question rather about what questions that you, our listeners, still have about intuitive eating, health at every size, feeding kids, or any questions that have kind of popped up from previous episodes. So we got some great responses and then a couple other questions that came through via friends and family, things that they are wondering about and wanted to address or wanted us to talk a little bit more about. So we're going to get into that today. And just as an initial disclaimer, some of the questions are kind of specific, but we're going to try our best to answer them pretty generally because this is not a substitute for, you know, professional or, I mean, we are professionals, but it's not a substitute for personalized medical or nutrition advice. So just kind of keep that in mind that this does not replace. Oh, we have a little coo of a dove over there.
There's a squeak over here.
And you'll hear all about that in just a minute. So just keep that in mind. The answers that we're providing today are general. And if you do need further assistance, you can absolutely feel free to reach out to one of us and we'll do our best to try to connect you with an appropriate health professional that can see you one-on-one. So without further ado, we're going to just jump in. We're going to start off with a couple life updates because both of us have had some exciting things happening. So Jen, you want to share a little bit?
So today is our first episode that we've recorded since I had our second girl, Ruthie Gray. She was born May 14th in quite the hurry, but we are doing well. We're about 5 weeks out now, and we're just adjusting to life as a family of four. Ruthie has been a great baby, and you know, we've just been focusing on helping Lila, our oldest, transition. But all is well, just kind of the newborn stuff, we're getting through it. And, you know, it's our second time, so it feels a little bit less scary. So all good, excited to be back and talking nutrition and intuitive eating and Hace and all the good stuff here. So
and hanging out with me.
And of course hanging out with you. That's my favorite part of all of this. So we're good. But Ruthie's here with me today, so you might hear some squeaks and coos and that's life of a working mom. We're gonna try to make this work.
So Ruthie's currently milk drunk right now.
She's so milk drunk,
And she's happy as a clam over in her little carrier.
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, 5 weeks out, you know, that's kind of the pros and cons of being a self-employed mom.
Totally.
Is that you can go back to work, but you also, I don't know. What do you?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's been really hard because right before she was born, I was like, okay, I'm going to get all this work done and give myself a little bit of a break. But the thing is when I take a break, that's it. I'm a one-woman show, except for, of course, the podcast. It's a two-woman show. But for the most part, everything is just me. So when I take a break, my business takes a break, and usually my income slows. So it can be a little scary to take too much time off. And I'm really passionate about what I do, so I don't really want to take too much time off. But it's hard. When you're in the thick of the newborn phase, your brain is just kind of like pooped. And I mean, especially having a toddler, it's just you're stretched really thin at first. So, you know, sometimes it's hard to collect my thoughts. So I've been pretty quiet on like social media and I've just been trying to kind of keep it slow, but keep a little bit of momentum.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't know. You can take as much time as you want, but not really, you know? Right. So here we are. We're good.
Yeah. Nice.
So let's hear a little bit from you, Andrea.
Well, I've just been here, you know, looking after my fur baby. He's napping in the chair.
Yep, like a little angel.
Archie dog. I keep joking with my husband that if we don't have a human child soon, we're going to suffocate him. So
it's okay. We started an Instagram for my dog before we had kids. That's how much we loved him. Yeah. And then the kids came and now our poor dog Bence gets like zero attention. Poor thing. But it does. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he does give us these looks occasionally that we interpret as like, you guys are ridiculous. Please get away from me. So anyway, that's that.
That's so funny.
Really important information to share. But as far as I'm concerned, you know, life is good. Just trying to keep on top of the kind of news around intuitive eating and health at every size. And that can be a little bit overwhelming sometimes because there is a lot of, you know, media coming at you from all directions.
Yeah.
I am feeling really positive and encouraged. I've been able to connect with a couple more intuitive eating and health at every size aligned dietitians in the past couple months.
That's great.
Just in Maine, which is really, really encouraging. So yeah, definitely feel like that this approach is growing and people are recognizing it, and like, even if they don't follow it, they know that it's there and it's not like, oh, you know, what is this kind of out of left field approach that people, like, there's an awareness of it, which is...
Yeah, momentum has definitely been growing. I feel like, especially since I've taken kind of a little maternity break and I've been off Instagram more than usual, I feel like every time I go back on it, I'm seeing, like, major news articles and lots more press and attention and... people kind of aligning themselves with the movement.
Yeah, so intuitive eating and health at every size in the news. I know that we both saw a couple articles in the last couple weeks. Yeah. So one of them was, what, a week ago on, well...
Yeah, I think it was about a week ago.
A week ago on Sunday in the New York Times. And the article was entitled, Smash the Wellness Industry. Yeah. And it was a really fantastic article.
Yeah, by Jessica Knoll.
Thank you, Jessica. And it just kind of outlined her process of coming to intuitive eating and kind of how she discovered all of these very sneaky ways that diet culture or wellness culture is really keeping women in particular down and obsessed with looks and their bodies and body shape and you know, being as quote-unquote healthy as possible, you know, instead of forging forward and having a more strong place in their careers and in society.
In life,
Is that kind of the gist of it? So if you haven't checked out that article yet, we'll link it in today's show notes.
Yes.
It is a really good read. I actually posted it at... work.
Oh, you did?
I printed it out. I was like, people need to read this.
Good for you. That's
a good
idea.
I mean, it's a little passive, you know.
Well, you know what? The information needs to get out there. Not everyone's on Instagram.
Passive activism, I guess. Yes.
And then the follow-up article to that was published by The Cut, which was...
Oh, I didn't see that one.
Yeah, What Does Intuitive Eating Even Mean? By Katie Haney, I believe it's pronounced. And... that was a great follow-up to it. That's just kind of a little bit less personal anecdotal and more of like, okay, here's what intuitive eating is, and this is what it looks like, and this is what it means. And I was really happy to see it in The Cut because I think a lot of people do follow that source. I don't know. I think it's really getting the word out there across the board, and I think a lot of publications are picking it up and happy to kind of share this information. So anyway... that was last week. Those two articles came out.
Yes.
And another one came out, too, that maybe got a little controversy.
Yeah, to say the least. So if you didn't see in the news, the Nike store in London in the UK, must have been a couple weeks ago now. It's hard to keep track of when
exactly. I know. I have no idea what day it is.
They put up a mannequin in like a plus size mannequin, so a mannequin in a larger body, a female body, in like tights or leggings and a sports bra, and that got, I mean, the first I saw of it, like, it got a lot of positive attention.
Yes,
you know,
that's, I noticed that too. It was
like,
just positive
about damn
at first.
Time.
Yeah,
and then I think it got not all positive reactions, but I think overall it was like, yes, this is a step in the right direction.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there was a person, a writer, I use that term loosely, but a writer who wrote an article in, what was it? The Telegraph?
Yes, The Telegraph. It's The Telegraph.
Which you informed me is kind of a...
not so savory.
Yeah.
Like, they don't really check their facts. And
okay.
It's, you know, it's not the best publication out
okay.
there.
Okay, so... The article came out probably a couple days after this mannequin was put up in the Nike London store. And I can't remember the title because I think I maybe just...
I don't know either.
Put it out of my mind.
Yeah.
But I'm not even going to say the name of the author because it was just such a horrendous article. Just completely fatphobic, mm-hmm. stigmatizing, hurtful, and... that got a lot of attention, unfortunately, too, because, you know, it was so brutal.
Oh, it was awful.
And the wild thing is that this person, we were joking, we're going to call her Lady Voldemort, because
that's... we shall not name her.
We shall not name her. Wrote an article, like, maybe a year ago that was about just letting people of size... be people of size, kind of like leaving them alone.
Yeah.
I don't think I read that article, but it was it's kind of like she's contradicting herself in this new article.
Yeah, my understanding is that she was sharing her experience as living in a larger body. I'm not sure that she used, I don't think she comfortably was aligning herself as a fat activist, but I'm pretty sure she was sharing her experience as a woman who has been shamed publicly for living in a larger body. And that obviously is very contradicting to the article that she did write, which we're not going to share too much about because we don't want to reiterate her points in her language. But it was just a very unkind view of why this mannequin in the Nike stores wasn't a good thing or is not a good thing, which we do not agree with. And so, yeah, it was just super disappointing. And so a lot of people came out of the woodwork that are fat phobic and aligned with her and said, you know, awful things. And it just goes to show that there's so much more work that needs to be done in our community as people who are, you know, we believe in health at every size. We are intuitive eating trained, and we consider ourselves advocates for fat positivity and body positivity.
Yeah.
And allies, I should say. So, you know, there's a lot more work that needs to be done by all of us to lift this message up and share it with the world so that more people have an understanding of what's going on and why we're trying to make a change and get away from the vice grip of diet culture that has us believing that smaller and thinner and wispier and waspy is a thing
and,
to...
and young and white. And...
young, white, yeah. All these things, it's, you know... we want to highlight body diversity and cultural diversity and all the things that make people people.
Right.
And unfortunately, just this goes to show this one woman just happened to amplify the voice of the fatphobic.
Right. And, you know, despite the fact that, you know, it's the Telegraph might not be the most reputable publication out there, this article got circulated.
Yeah.
And... I think, you know, after we realized that she had previously written this other article about her experience as a woman in a larger body, it kind of just went to show that she wrote this article, it seemed just to be inflammatory.
Yeah.
And again, like you said, that while that might be the case and, you know, it seems like this person has a lot of internalized fat phobia, you know, it still gave a place for people to direct their hateful comments.
Yeah. So... their biases and just uninformed opinions.
Right. There's a hashtag that is probably worth following if you're on social media, which is lose hate, not weight.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. Or I think it might be lose the hate, not the weight. But either one, I think it's one to look out for. And I think that's one that I'll try to start using because we need to lose the hate.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not helpful. And I think to your point about being advocates, you know, all humans are deserving of compassionate medical care,
yep,
and informed medical care, and they don't deserve to be, you know, just dwindled down to this like one aspect of their being,
yeah,
and have everything blamed on that, which is what we hear about from people who have lived that experience.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So bummer that that was kind of the follow-up to the Nike situation, but hopefully it does kind of ignite a fire in all of us who consider ourselves allies to the cause, so that we can just lift the voices of the marginalized and the fat to have a better platform to share their experiences, their lived experiences, so that we can empathize as humans with each other and make a change, because it's about damn time.
It is about damn time. So do you want to get into our first question?
Because
I think this
it.
Is a good a
little segue.
So,
okay, so this question came from a listener via Instagram, and they asked, how do we as consumers and voters make real change in our communities regarding health at every size? I see a lot of applause of retail companies using plus-size models, which I agree is a great start, but I wonder where you think the real systemic change should happen.
This is a great question. I think that's probably one that we have thought a lot about personally, you know, how we can elevate the message of health at every size.
And something that we've in depth and length talked about off mic.
Yes.
And, you know, it's hard to answer it really succinctly because there's so many different ways we think and layers to it.
So as a side note, we have recorded this question before, and it got so ranty that we are recording it
re-recording.
Again. Just to kind of bring our thoughts and kind of what came from that initial ranty conversation, kind of just have it a bit more succinct and hopefully digestible for...
And actionable.
And actionable for our listeners. So, yes, we agree that, you know, having plus-size models is great, but, you know, mannequins that are representing larger body sizes, those are a really good start, and I think we should continue to support and shed light on the companies that are making those changes, because I think it is a big move in the right direction. One of the ways that I like to promote health at every size and share resources and information is through social media, of course. So Instagram, Facebook, like to share podcasts and books, as well as peer-reviewed research, which is a little bit harder to digest because not everybody is loving to read a research paper.
Sure.
But there are, as we talked about previously, there are a lot of good articles coming out in major news publications that are shedding light on intuitive eating and, you know, how diets really don't work and how this obsessive focus on body size and shape and weight is really doing us all a huge disservice. So sharing things to read, things to listen to, that kind of thing.
Yeah, the kind of get familiar with the facts and the statistics and reshare them when you learn of a new one, or just kind of familiarize yourself via the podcasts and the books so that when the conversation inevitably comes up, you have, you know, the real hard facts to share.
Definitely.
So the second thing that we would share with you is to support the work and the messages of people in marginalized bodies. So the people that are living in fat bodies, the people who are the fat advocates and the people writing the books and sharing their experiences. That is emotional labor, and they're doing it for the most part for free, and that creates fatigue. So what we want to do is we want to support that population of people who are doing this real hard work and sharing it in a vulnerable place where they get attacked on the daily. So we need to help elevate their message. We need to support them in their work. And that kind of support is, of course, resharing and following, but more importantly, it's financially. So, you know, if you have the means to support somebody's work via Patreon or Venmo or PayPal, that is an excellent place to start. Even if you only have a couple dollars a month to spare, I highly recommend that's a priority.
Yeah, buying their books.
Yeah, buy their books.
There are a lot of great books out. We can make a little list of them.
Yeah.
And share those in the show notes today. I'll also say that by supporting and sharing messages from people in marginalized bodies, it's taking yourself, if you are a person, you know, like myself, who's in a thinner body, mm-hmm. I'm not centering the message on myself. Yeah. I want to elevate the voices of people who are sharing their lived experiences, yeah. because I think that's got to be so much more powerful and so much more difficult for them, because...
Yeah. Well, I think fat phobia is so ingrained in our culture that we dehumanize fat bodies. And so we need to rehumanize them and hear their messages. And as somebody in a straight size, regardless of if you've struggled with, you know, your weight or not, it's not really about us, because we're comfortable. We can go into a store and buy, for the most part, anything that we pick. We can probably find our size. Even if we don't love it, we might not buy it. It still fits. You know, you don't get looks of disgust when you're walking through the grocery store. You're going to have an ice cream cone or sit on an airplane. You know, we don't experience that level of stigma. So it's not for us to share our experiences in, you know, our dissatisfaction with our body. We need to make space for the people who are actually living in these bodies.
Yeah. So again, I think we mentioned this before, but supporting brands, organizations, companies that are making some kind of genuine effort to show that they support body mm-hmm. diversity. So, you know, Dove has a new campaign mm-hmm. out, which is Show Me. I think it's hashtag Show Me. So it's not only large bodies, but just diverse bodies. Mm-hmm. So I think things like that are yep. more commonplace, which is encouraging to see. But there's obviously other maybe smaller brands that yes. people yeah. like to support as well.
Yeah, so, you know, it could be Nike that you support because you appreciate their latest rollout with their, you know, diverse mannequins. Or it could be that you prefer to spend your dollars in small businesses and impact, you know, the smaller scale. And that's great, too. So do the research. Really dig deep and see how transparent this company is. Like, are they saying, I've seen a couple of brands say that they have, you know, plus sizes and it ends at 16, and that's not really a plus size, that would be our normal place straight size. So really look in and don't just see a marketing message and take it at face value, but do a little bit more research, and then support the brands that are truly authentically supporting body diversity and health at every size.
Another thing would be, I guess, in a more small capacity with maybe in your immediate circle, would be to plant seeds with friends and family.
Yeah.
You know, we all have those family members that kind of make offhand comments mm-hmm. that might not sit so well with us, or we're worried about having little ears hear those things yeah. and kind of take those things to heart. If we have comments that come through that are teaching children that it's not okay to be in a larger body, like that's not good. So right. I think there's certainly planting seeds. Yeah. So
setting boundaries
with language, mm-hmm. you know, saying something like, you know, we don't talk about bodies that way in our family, please do not say that in front of my kid. Mm-hmm. And I think boundaries are boundaries. I mean, yeah. those are, I think I heard Evelyn Tribbley kind of define those as loving boundaries.
Yeah.
I kind of imagine it like putting an arm around your, either the your family or your person or your kids, you know, you're setting a boundary around them. That doesn't really make sense, so I might re-record that. But
no, that's okay. Well, another way to define a boundary isn't just a hard no and you're shutting people out, you're showing them the door. So you're showing them the right way in. It's not just them trampling through the garden, so to speak. You know, it shows them exactly where to go. And that is helpful for both sides. People appreciate that information, just as you would probably feel a lot more satisfied by setting that boundary. All of this being said, planting the seeds with friends and family, that's hard to do. It's hard to speak up against diet culture. It's hard to speak up against fat phobia in, you know, such a black and white way, which is often kind of what needs to happen. But going back to like planting the seeds is just saying, you know, if you're able to say, that's not really a conversation I'm very interested in participating in anymore, and here's why. Mm. Not everybody has that kind of relationship with friends and family, and if for you don't feel safe to share that information, then of course, you know, just disengaging and walking away is of course the safest thing to do. But when it comes to true advocacy, planting seeds and being a voice and having the information and the statistics and the facts, have that in your back pocket so then at your next next family, you know, Thanksgiving or whatever it is, you can say, well, actually, this is the real statistic, and just plant that seed. It doesn't have to be a huge conversation, mm-hmm. but it needs to get people thinking outside of diet culture, and
right.
that will do it.
Which is, so many people just take, you know, certain health risks or whatever as a given, right?
Yes,
because
right.
that's the message that we are constantly fed, is that X equals Y, or
this is a problem, or
this body size is at a risk or a cause, or whatever it is for, you know, X, Y, Z. So, yeah, just kind of presenting them with some new information that might help them think twice. Even if they don't change their mind, they mm-hmm. might just shut up when they're around you. So, and then, of course, you know, we all have our own unlearning to do and continuing to check our own biases. Mm-hmm. So that's something that we can always do. So in addition to sharing, you know, messages from people in marginalized bodies, taking the time to read those yourselves, mm-hmm. you know, mull them over, sit with them, sit with the uncomfortable feelings that might come from checking your biases, checking your privilege. Mm-hmm. That's all work that we can all continue to do, is the change begins within,
yes.
as they say. And then we probably feel more comfortable to speak on those things once we've kind of done the internal work too.
Yeah. And one of my favorite quotes is from Mother Teresa, and it is, if you want to change the world, go home and love your family. And I think that, you know, it feels overwhelming and daunting, all the changes that need to happen before we really find a place of peace with health at every size and body diversity, and can eradicate fat phobia and, you know, weight stigma. But at the end of the day, if we can help equip the next generation, which is part of the point of this podcast,
yes.
but if we can help equip the next generation with the skills and the tools to make a change, that is the most important thing I think we can do. So if you're a parent, you know, changing that language inside your home, setting that boundary as your home is a safe space, and understand that language is huge. And just really helping our kids, because I think, you know, it might not be too late for us, but I think there's still a lot of hope and time for the next generation. So let's put our focus there.
And that's, like you said, that's what it came down to when we decided to launch into this project, is mm-hmm. like, we want to focus our attention on the next generation, mm-hmm. where we see there is so much potential and it is so much hope to reverse the damage that has been done.
Yeah.
So thank you for tuning in, for listening, and for being interested in this and interested in trying to raise the next generation and to be healthy in body and healthy in mind, and to have really positive views of themselves. And is that it?
I think so. Oh, you know what? There's actually one resource that you can take. I think it's in the back of the Health at Every Size book. They might even have a printout now, but I think Leah mentioned it in our previous podcast. So that is something to have, to print out, to give to your child's doctor, your own doctor. I guess really anybody that is going to talk about health and wellness around you, you know, have a printout. And just kind of, that's a good way to plant the seed that doesn't necessarily put that burden on you. If, you know, you're interested in the advocacy part, but you don't feel maybe equipped to speak on it, or you maybe don't feel like you have the space to speak on it with maybe a health professional, you know, this printout will do the talking for you.
Yeah.
So that's also a good resource.
Yes. And if we can find the PDF, we can
link it.
All right, that's that.
Okay, so our next question came in to the Food Confidence Podcast page.
Yep.
And this person asks, how do you deal with kids asking for sweets or sugary foods first thing in the morning? Yeah, I can relate.
Yeah?
Yes, Lila has a little bit of a sweet tooth. That's her preference. And so first thing in the morning, she's been known to go and open the freezer and ask for ice cream.
Okay.
As breakfast.
Okay.
So I can relate to you, Mama.
So any, you know, how do you typically deal with that?
Well, first I, like, sit there and stare at her and wonder if this is the type of day that we're going to have. And then I usually just say, you know, that's not what we're having for breakfast. We're going to have X, and I'll name whatever food I already had kind of planned in my head. Mm-hmm. Or I'll say, you know what, we're not going to have ice cream. Just at this moment, we can have X or Y, and then I'll give her two choices. She's 2.5, so she's pretty good at throwing the tantrum at this stage, so she'll maybe freak out for a little bit, and I'll remind her we can have it later in the day, mm-hmm. That it's just a not right now thing, and she usually settles down, and then I kind of talk to her about what it is that she wants, and she can usually get herself off of it the more options, like the more we talk about other options.
Right.
So that's typically how we do it.
So really just goes back to the division of responsibility, exactly. Right? So it's totally fine and appropriate as the parent or caregiver to set those boundaries, mm-hmm. to say, no, that's not what we're having right now. Mm-hmm. We're having this or that, or give them a choice. You can have this or that for breakfast. That's what we're having right now.
Yep.
So yeah, that's kind of what came to my mind as mm-hmm. well.
And it doesn't have to be a total hard no, right. either. So I'll share this experience that a client had, who I'll keep anonymous, but she has young kids, and there's one particular cereal that her child really enjoys. And so in an attempt to try to integrate more intuitive eating into their family, she allows the cereal in her home because it's her child's preference. But she said she was having a hard time because then her child was asking for it at every single meal. Oh. And so I think because it was new and exciting in the home, that was like kind of keeping her attention to it. Mm-hmm. And so in that scenario, when you don't want to necessarily give it a hard no because you're still transitioning into that freedom around food, the best thing to do, I would say, is to give lots of options, and that one food being among those options.
Right.
So sit them at the table and give them like a little bento box or whatever, kind of those like divided plates with a little bit of everything, including that one food that maybe you're kind of grappling with. Mm-hmm. And let them graze and pick and choose and draw no particular attention to it, but let them navigate their plate.
Right. Yeah. And I think I've talked to one mom in particular comes to mind, as she was trying to come to terms with maybe releasing some of that control and around certain foods. And I think that like when adults start on their intuitive eating journey, there is kind of this time frame where maybe we kind of do a bit of rebellion and you kind mm-hmm. of allow yourself to have more of those foods that you yep. might end up
yep.
eating totally in the typical. End. Yeah. And I think the same goes for kids. Like when they've not had access to certain foods that they've maybe their friends have access to and they really want, but they've mm-hmm. never, you know, been had in the house, and you're kind of parents are releasing some of that restriction. There's a bit of trust that needs to be rebuilt that that food isn't going to go away again.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
So I think that's one thing that comes to mind for me. So
yeah, I agree.
I also wonder, I mean, I think the division of responsibility is first and foremost. I also wonder, do you think kids can be like really super hungry in the morning?
Totally.
Like, when people are really super hungry, we get that primal hunger where we yep. really want, you know, quick digesting carbohydrates.
Yep.
So maybe do you think that's where it's coming from? Mm-hmm. Or perhaps they just want like a sweet breakfast food. Like
yeah.
if they prefer pancakes or French toast or sweet yogurt with fruit, maybe mm-hmm. those things will do that, you know, might be satisfying as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I guess there's lots of different options.
Yeah.
I guess what also the thing that comes to mind too, like maybe this would be, I'd love to hear your thoughts, but like an older kid maybe,
yeah.
you know, kid comes down for breakfast and is like, I want ice cream for breakfast.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, go at it, have it, but I want you to, you know, be listening to your body.
Yeah.
That kind of language.
I think probably for like an older kid, you'd be able to have a more rational conversation. Maybe
right.
not entirely rational, but hopefully a little bit more, so that you could say, you know, you're going to school today, and it's really important that you have the energy to make it to lunch, because I know you don't get snack anymore, you know, or, you know, whatever
right.
it is. You can
right.
say, you know, you let's brain food today because you've got a big test. So let's have this oatmeal and we'll put some sweet maple syrup on it.
Right.
You know, whatever right. it may be. It doesn't have to
chocolate
be a hard...
Chocolate granola.
Yeah, chocolate granola. Exactly. It does not have to be a hard no. It just has to... I think the conversation needs to exist so that the children that we are trying to raise and keep within intuitive eating have the tools to do so.
Right.
And to know why we as the parents are setting certain boundaries.
Right. Yeah. And then the last thing that comes to mind mm-hmm. with this particular question is, like, does the child have access to those things on a regular basis?
Yeah.
So that's where I think... where you said initially is like, no, we're not having that now, but maybe we'll have it later. And yeah. I think that goes for any kind of food too, like for meals, if a kid's like, no, I don't want this mm-hmm. for dinner, or mm-hmm. I want this instead. Well, we're not having that right now. We're having this. Maybe we can have that another day.
Yeah.
Like, we can have that food another time.
Yep.
So
yeah. Sometimes I'll say to Lila, you know, no, we can't have, or we're not going to have, you know, ice cream for breakfast today, but we can have that after we get back from X, Y, or Z, an activity that she knows is happening that day.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so I'll say, we're going to have this for breakfast. We'll have that after gymnastics or this play date or whatever it is. And then when we come home, I'll ask her, do you still want this? And yeah. sometimes she'll say yes, and sometimes she'll say no.
Mm, okay.
So that might give you a little, at first they might say yes every single time, and that's totally fine. You told them they could have it.
Right.
And sometimes they'll say no, and you'll maybe be a little bit shocked, but that just goes to show that they're on the right track of continuing their intuitive eating, and you're on the right track as a parent to keep them, you know, in that space. So
yeah,
that's it.
So hopefully that answers the question, and we gave you some kind of different options. You know, yeah. there's no right or wrong. Like, want to make sure that our listeners feel that they have every right to do what they feel is best for their family.
Yeah.
So we're not trying to be prescriptive.
No.
Just kind of offer some different perspectives
yeah.
and some, you know, things that you could try.
Yeah. And I'll say one more thing before we move on to the next question. And that is, yesterday or 2 days ago, Lila asked for ice cream for breakfast because it's truly her favorite food. She tells you that all the time. You'll say, what's your favorite food? And she'll say, melon and ice cream. So she asked for ice cream, and I said, you know what, we're not going to have ice cream for breakfast today, but you can have, and I said, she really likes marshmallows, so I said, you can have marshmallows instead. And the reason for that was because I know that she gets really filled up on ice cream, and so I wanted her to eat a little bit more diversity for breakfast, and so I offered her basically, like, I made a trail mix.
Oh.
And I put marshmallows in it, and that totally satisfied her, and she was really happy with that, and we moved on. So she got something that she really enjoyed from it, and I was able to feel confident that I set the right boundaries for her for that particular day. So, you know, it wasn't necessarily a breakfast food. It was basically a trail mix with marshmallows for breakfast, but
yeah.
it worked and it satisfied her, and I know that she didn't feel restricted.
And you know, she got protein, fats, and carbs.
She got all the things.
Gang's all there.
Gang's all there. The three musketeers.
All right, so another question that came to us through, I forget what channel, but another question was, what could somebody do perhaps to help curb or remove cravings for sugar if they're trying to rebuild their intuitive eating relationship, or they're maybe on their intuitive eating journey?
Yeah, I think this person was specifically interested too in removing it from their drinks.
Their drinks, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, using sugar in coffee or drinking other kinds of sugary
drinks. Yep.
And so my first question to that would be, where is the fear around sugar in beverages coming from?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we probably know that it's coming from diet culture
yeah.
and the fear that we have around sugar in general and...
Right, quote-unquote, drinking your calories.
Right, you and know. All of the messaging around, you know, reducing sugary drinks.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I will say, it says reduce sugary drinks. It doesn't say eliminate sugary drinks.
Yeah.
Most of the messages that
right.
I have seen, you know, public health messages and things like that.
Yeah.
So... Why the fear about having sugar in coffee? I mean, mm-hmm. from my personal perspective, So when I go home, when I go home to Nova Scotia, my parents, my dad makes like tar coffee. Like it is so strong. Like it's undrinkable for me, even with like a good amount of cream or milk in it. Like yeah. It's still very, very bitter.
Doesn't do it. Yeah.
And I will be definitely putting some coffee in that so that I
sugar in that.
I will
add some coffee to the coffee.
And I will definitely be adding some sugar to that coffee so that I can sip and enjoy that morning beverage.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Are you enjoying the beverages that you are consuming, or has diet culture dictated your choices around these beverages? Mm-hmm. You know, or maybe even you're using beverages to curb appetite as a diet culture tool, and if that's the case, you're not maybe necessarily enjoying your beverages as much. So, you know, there's a lot of questions to ask yourself of where that thought process is coming from, or maybe the fear or desire.
Right.
Where is that coming from? And then, you know, ask yourself, would I enjoy this more if it were a real lemonade versus, you know, real as in like a homemade lemonade that has the whole sugar and the whole lemon and the whole shebang.
Right.
And allow yourself to have that. And you know, do you enjoy that? Is that something that you want to enjoy? Then have that drink and enjoy it. That kind of barrier that also releases that burden.
Right. It's the permission mm-hmm. that you're missing there to sit down and enjoy a beverage, mm-hmm. if it's sweet or not.
Mm-hmm. And that's usually the reason we're bringing up removing that restriction and the unconditional permission, is because typically when somebody comes to us and says that they'd like to remove or reduce a craving,
right,
that is coming from a place of fear and restriction. And so that's why we're addressing the unconditional permission part of intuitive eating here.
Absolutely. And I think another thing that intuitive eating, you know, maybe further on down the line, when you're kind of further on in your intuitive eating, you know, journey, is it asks us to zoom out and get a more objective, realistic picture of what we're eating in a day, in a week, in a month.
Yes.
And if we zoom out and, you know, are we really consuming maybe more added sugar than we think we should, or we think is healthy. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, if we have a extra sugary drink or, you know, dessert or something like that, that is probably just one little piece of what we've eaten in a whole day or a whole week, right?
Right.
So it's, and we enjoyed it, mm-hmm. right? So we have that positive aspect of it. So yes, you know, we understand that not all food is nutritionally equal, but
right.
if we zoom out and take a larger lens to our overall eating patterns, it's more than likely that we'll see, hopefully, if we've done the work to kind of work through some of the diet mentality, that we are eating a variety of foods
mm-hmm.
and we are getting a balance overall.
Mm-hmm.
And really that, you know, having sugar in your coffee every morning is not something you need to be fretting over.
Yeah. And I also think that diet culture has a way of creating fear around things that are unnecessary to fear. So what I mean by that is it creates a fear for you for something that you already actually are doing it just fine.
Mm-hmm.
And you have some awareness, which is what's evoking that fear. So you're aware that, fine, maybe reducing sugary drinks is, you know, an important thing, but you already have that awareness, and so you don't need to fear it. You just need to kind of exist with that awareness and let it help you make your decisions as to, okay, does this sound good or not?
Right. So basically you're saying, like, having the awareness, you kind of start with the awareness of, I think I might be eating or drinking too many sugary drinks, for example,
yeah.
and I would really like to change that behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe it comes back to releasing the judgment from that. Like, oh, I'm such a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
I drink too many sugary drinks and I really need to change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where diet culture does.
Right.
Versus, it's like, if you have the awareness, you can make the change in an unbiased way without letting diet culture dictate it for you.
Right.
And so, you know, that kind of goes back to your original question about the sugary drinks of, like, what does your week look like?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know your day and your schedule way better than anybody else. So release the judgment and let yourself make the decisions on what really truly sounds good, and you'll be able to do it in a sustainable way.
And I guess one final thought from a from a more food standpoint, I am just like kind of focusing on the coffee piece. But if you're having coffee, are you putting like skim milk in that coffee? Oh. Or are you putting, you know, half and half or cream?
Yeah.
Or something that's going to give it a more rich, like satisfying mouthfeel and flavor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So maybe if you're really kind of gung-ho on reducing the amount of sugar you're putting in your coffee.
Yeah, like maybe you're putting like 16 tablespoons of sugar in your coffee.
Right.
And if that's the case, then like...
Do you like coffee?
Do you like coffee? And maybe the way you're doing it isn't working for you. And mm-hmm. so, yeah, maybe try whole milk. Try...
Cream.
Try a latte. You know,
right.
try, you know, create... Maybe create new opportunities and new experiences around that food
right.
to really investigate.
Experiment.
Yeah.
Experiment with what you actually like and what sounds good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a great point, because that's part of relearning intuitive eating, right? Is like having those little experiments where you relearn what you actually enjoy eating.
What your preferences are. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So I guess removing cravings, you know, that's a very strong diet culture co-opted thing.
Right.
So we don't want to ever remove cravings, because then we'd be dead. I don't know. You know, we want to be able to dictate what foods sound good. So, I guess ask yourself where that thought is coming from and what's dictating this fear or desire.
And if you can consider removing that fear.
Yeah.
Like coming at it in a more neutral place.
Yep.
And... yeah,
and then
no judgment.
And then play and experiment and see which ways you like that food or drink, you know.
Right.
Until you find what works for you.
So hopefully that offers you some food for thought.
Some guidance.
So that wraps up part one of our first Q&A episode. Thanks to everyone who sent in questions. We have a few more questions that we didn't get to today, so we hope to release part two of the Q&A in just a few weeks. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll talk to you soon.
You've been listening to the Food Confidence Podcast. I'm Jennifer Bravo.
And I'm Andrea Paul.
If you have any questions about the things you heard in today's episode or have topics you'd like us to discuss in the future, send us an email at foodconfidencepod@gmail.com or follow us and message us on Instagram at foodconfidencepod.